be your train. But when you knee deep in water, looking for something to blame.
You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show, the number one talk show choice of many galaxies.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, and that's a guarantee. You know, over the past couple of years, interest in and concern about the year 2012 has rapidly increased and intensified into near obsession levels with some folks. There have been many DVDs, books have been written, television documentaries produced, all dealing with the various prophecies and the various 2012 scenarios. And right along with 2012 are all the scenarios about the end of time, because some of the 2012 prophecies and 2012 scenarios deal with that. Some of the theories about 2012 say that we're approaching something wonderful, and that it's not going to be the end of time, but a great ascension to a glorious new level of existence, an evolutionary leap forward. Other theories say that nothing much will happen on December the 21st, 2012, and yet others envision great calamities, dire conditions, death, destruction. Now, along with this group of theories, we include all the various prophetic writings, and that would include Sumerian, Mayan, Hopi Indian, and biblical theories that talk about great cataclysms, world turmoil, tyranny. Well, the Mayan prophecies, Hopi Indian prophecies, and the end of the Jewish calendar, the New Age prophecies, Nostradamus, and biblical prophecies are all in that mix. And they all say we're coming to some type of great climax in human history. Some of them give the date 2012. Some give no date, but even those say that the time is very near. Now, over the past weeks, I've seen an increase in the email that expresses real concern about 2012. We've also had a number of callers to the show that have expressed some concern about 2012. So I know that it's something that's very much on the minds of our audience. So this week, I have invited a series of guests who have expertise in the subject of 2012 and the end times. Not all the guests this week, but most of them. Each of them brings a distinctively different perspective. In many cases, they're looking at the same evidence, but have a different perspective on it, a completely different take. Now, in keeping with the philosophy of this show, we're going to ask them to present their case, and then we're going to ask questions. You'll have the opportunity to call in and ask your questions of them as well, and I hope you'll avail yourself of that opportunity to ask your questions rather than resorting to sending me an email a few days later asking me the questions. I always enjoy getting your email, but I'm not the guy with the answers. The guests have the answers, and you need to call them and ask them. If you think they're wrong, you need to call them and tell them why you think they're wrong. If you think they're right, you need to call them and tell them why you think they're right. It is, after all, a talk show. We'll be back with our first guest in this series, Dr. Brooks Agnew, right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Dr. Brooks Agnew. I think those of you who are regular listeners already know Dr. Agnew. And if you don't listen to this program regularly, if you are a new listener, you've heard him on Coast to Coast. You've heard him on his show, and which, by the way, is one of the leading talk shows having to do with edge information that's available on the Internet. So it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Brooks Agnew back to the Kevin Smith Show. Welcome back, Doctor.
Oh, thank you, Kevin. Good to be here.
Now, one of the there's so many things when we invite you to come on the show. There are so many things we could talk about because you're just involved in so many things. You're a best-selling author, and we're going to be talking about some of what you've written tonight. You are a scientist, an engineer, a businessman, an entrepreneur, and you've just got yourself involved in so many, many things that we could go a lot of different directions. Now, I do want to tell our audience that Dr. Agnew is involved with a company that is developing electric automobiles, electric cars. And they have some pretty amazing developments, and we're going to be talking with you, Dr. Agnew. We've got you scheduled for September the 18th for that, and we're going to devote the whole show to energy independence and looking forward to a day when we don't spend all that money on all of that fuel that's polluting our air.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Now, let's kind of focus our attention tonight on this 2012 scenario. With regard to the 2012 scenario, you've been involved with a project called the Horizon Project. You've written about what's coming. You have been on radio talking about what you see coming, and I want us to sort of get your perspective on this. We're hearing a lot of scenarios that are very dire and end of time kind of scenarios. It would seem to me, I could be wrong, that has happened before. I marked it on my calendar, as a matter of fact, the day that I was wrong, but and I have an anniversary for that each year. But it would seem to me that since you're so involved in the development of alternative energy, and you're so involved in the development of this electrical car, and other things that you're involved in are very futuristic, it would seem to me that you see a future beyond 2012.
Well, that's one of the most interesting things that we found after my co-author, Ethan Park, and I finished with pretty close to 1,500 pages on the 2012 end times. We started with the Union of the Polarity, and we ended up with cracking the Mayan calendar code and bringing in Egyptian and Hittite and Babylonian and even Sumerian texts. Try to explain why it is so many ancient civilizations were so concerned about our time when it seems they had their own things to worry about. And what we found at the end of this was there was almost universally, and of course we came out with our first book in 2004, not many books on the shelves then, about 2012, but boy, go to the shelves now and you find a whole bunch of them. But you're right, they all have this very dire doom and gloom, end of days message. You better buy your bunker and you better dig it deep. But what we found at the end of all this is a great message of hope. And what we found was that the reason these ancient civilizations left their message for us is not so that we would know when the lights are going to go out, but so that we could make preparations to try to move the planet and move the conditions of the planet to a different state of mind, so that these coming cataclysms weren't extinction events for the human race.
Okay, now, when you say move the planet to a different state of mind, what are you talking about? What's up with that?
Well, it's going to take a while to develop this, but here is the thread of it. As it turns out, the matter that makes up the Earth, all the minerals on it, all the molecules that make up the planet, are of two different kinds of matter. One is a very high energy matter and one is a fairly low energy matter. Now these two forms of matter came from different parts of the universe. They may have come from different dimensions, and they blended to make this planet what it is right now. It's a very, very rare hunk of rock floating in the cold darkness of space. And when I talk to geologists about this, they kind of raise their eyebrows, but they understand what I'm talking about, because there is a portion of the Earth that's very, very old, about 4.5 billion years old. There's also a portion of the Earth that's very, very young, between 10 million and 70 million years old. Now, that's a big time difference. Now, the interesting thing is that the young part of the world is still growing. The actual circumference of the Earth is still growing. Now, when I talk about the fact that there's two kinds of matter put together on the Earth, to metaphysicians, they understand perfectly what I'm talking about. That there is a sort of energy to this Earth, a life pulse. Now, if you look at it as a planet, you say, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But if you look at it as a being, it makes a whole lot of sense. Because aren't we just water and a few minerals and proteins and things put together in a certain genetic pattern? We are two forms of matter as well. We're this lower energy matter that's the thing that we bump and bruise every day. And we're the higher form of matter, that animated being that's on the inside of this body that makes it do what it does, makes it think and feel and love and despair and hope and desire. So when you draw this big picture, you see that what makes up our physical bodies is the dust of the Earth. We, our bodies, are consuming the minerals of the Earth. So our consciousness, individually and as a race of humans, is tied directly to the Earth. The Earth needs us, and we need the Earth.
Okay, and go a little further with this Earth being a living being.
Well, when, for instance, we compare Earth to other planets, let's just compare it to our nearest neighbor, Mars. If we were to compare Earth to Mars, you would look at the surface of the world and say, well, Mars is pretty much sterile. There's very little atmosphere. There's no microbial life. There's no fresh water flowing around on it. It could be a function of its distance from the sun. But let's look at, say, the magnetosphere. Earth has a magnetosphere. Mars does not. Earth has a lot of features on it that Mars did not. They're so close to one another, you think, well, gee, they were formed out of the same accretion disk. They should be pretty similar. We're not even similar to our moon. Our moon is mostly aluminum and titanium, and the Earth is mostly iron and nickel.
So okay.
When I talk about it being a living being, I mean that the planet itself has a grid of consciousness around it. consciousness, and I don't just mean human consciousness. I mean pure consciousness. Everything in the trees, the rocks, the water, the air itself. And then, of course, there's sentient consciousness, which is humans, dolphins, whales, maybe even animals, maybe even squids. We don't know. They're highly intelligent. It's hard to tell. But there are other sentient beings on the earth besides humans. The consciousness of all those beings add to the quality of life on this planet. And this planet periodically seems to have an allergic reaction to the condition of humankind. From time to time, the planet has a sort of convulsion called a cataclysm, and it can literally wipe out a big portion of the human race. It's done it before. Atlantis has sunk. Lemuria has sunk. The Sumerians disappeared. Even the Mayans walked away from their cities. Nobody knows why. But they all left messages behind for us. Not for them, not for their descendants, for us in this time, 2012. The question is, why? And I'm going to answer that in just a minute.
Okay.
A lot of people ask the question, who built those pyramids? And why were pyramids built in China, in India, in Yucatan, in Mexico, in Russia? Why are there pyramids on the bottom of the ocean? Did they all have a common source, like a common origin? We all lived in the same village and then we spread out across the world. Did visitors come from another world to here to teach us this kind of architecture? Why would those, each and every one of those societies, spend such a large amount of their gross national product, as it were, to build edifices to alert us to a condition that's coming in 2012? Why wouldn't they just build storage places for their grain or water pumps or power generation systems or even tombs for their dead?
So you're saying that the pyramids that we find all over the earth, these pyramidal structures have the purpose of alerting us to something?
Yes, and here's why. Because when the architects were sitting down designing that, and keep in mind, the design and construction of these things sometimes took generations. The Great Pyramid of Giza took 20 years to build. Nowadays, that would be considered a major engineering project, but back then, it took generations of people to build something like that. They didn't have the lifespan and the nutrition that we have today. Even though it took that long to build, there were no engineering changes. Everything stayed exactly on course, exactly on design. I can tell you right now, if one project, I don't care if it's a steering wheel or a Rubik's Cube, gets handed from one engineer to another, it's going to change. But those buildings didn't change, not a one of them. And the reason they didn't change is because they needed to make a statement of their engineering prowess that was so beyond anything we thought they could do. I mean, we thought they were rubbing two sticks together to make fire. We thought they were polishing copper to make mirrors, and they didn't even know what a wheel was. And yet they built these edifices. The reason they built them is because they wanted us in this day to stand in front of those things with our fingers in our hair and our fist on the bottom of our chin going, how in the heck did they build that thing? They really wanted us to investigate it, because when we did, we found the answer as to why they built it and who built them.
All right, let's talk first about why they built them.
They built them so that they would survive all the cataclysms. They knew that there would be a wipeout by water. They knew there'd be a wipeout by fire, by ice, by wind, and they wanted the edifices to be able to survive. So that was one engineering criteria. The other is they had to be aligned to the four cardinal points of the earth. Pretty interesting, seeing as how a compass wasn't even invented for 1,500 more years. All these edifices are aligned. Whether you go to the Temple of the Sun, the Temple of the Moon, the Giza Pyramid, the ones in Tikal, the ones in China, they're all aligned north, east, south, and west. exactly within just a few increments. They also needed to point to a certain star system, which they all do. The Pleiades, Orion, and they tend to point to these star systems because they want us to look in that direction, either because that's where we came from, or that's where we're going, or that's where something is going to come from. So that's why they built them. But the biggest reason was to get us to say, get us to really wonder and to investigate. And the key to that is who built them. Now, I mean, oftentimes we can say, well, these were ancient civilizations. They really didn't know what they were doing, or they all had a common origin, or they were scattered at the Tower of Babel. Sorry, the dates don't line up, people. I mean, they're like 10,000 years apart, so they don't line up. It's a different reason. Here's the key. Key is that we do not have just one round on this earth as a mortal being. We are eternal beings having a mortal experience, and we have many mortal experiences. I don't think there's a single person, and maybe very few churches on this planet, that can deny that. We realize that we are eternal beings. We don't just pop into existence when we spew the last bit of amniotic fluid out of our lungs, and we don't go back to the dust and disappear for all time as soon as we expend our last breath of air. We have lived before, and we will live after. And if that's true, one of the favorite ways to live is in a mortal body, because we learn a lot, and we tend to There's a physics reason why we do this. And I don't want to give you all the answers right before you're going to break at the bottom of the hour. So
yeah, we've got a break in about a minute and 10 seconds.
Okay, this is a continuous thought that needs to be laid out. So
okay, well, let's go back and talk about the pyramids themselves. These pyramids, as you said, show up in many, many different locations around the earth, different cultures, and they're built at different times. So does this indicate a sort of single civilization that was doing this? That is one of the theories, that it was a particular civilization that was doing this and that they spread out across the earth.
Yes, that is one, that there was a common origin, like they all came from Atlantis and they spread out across the planet and they built them as soon as they were capable of mastering the engineering. The trouble is timelines. Atlantis ostensibly existed some 35,000 years ago, and 25,000 years ago they began to travel around the planet.
Well, the break caught us anyway. All right, we'll be back with Brooks Agnew on the other side of this break. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Dr. Brooks Agnew is my guest, and we are talking about 2012. And from his perspective and based on his research and investigation, what he thinks it's all about. And we were talking about the pyramids as we went to break, and we were talking about, you know, are they from a common culture? Are they from a one single culture that spread out across the earth? And you were just getting into that and explaining to us, I think, why that's not the case.
Well, yes. I mean, there's a couple of different reasons. One is anthropological. It is almost impossible to say from the genetic picture that we have today that all races came from a common origin, at least in the distant past, 20,000-30,000 years ago. If you want to take it further than that, a couple hundred thousand years, then maybe. But we don't have any pyramids on the Earth that old. What we do have, however, is this common theme of aligning these four-sided edifices to the cardinal points of the earth. And one of the things that we've noticed is that these pyramids, whether the ones in Tikal or the ones in Giza or elsewhere on the planet, even in Stonehenge, we're not talking about a pyramid, but we are talking about a very strange stone edifice, they align like a cosmic clock. Some of them align perfectly with the sun to tell when the solstices happen and when the equinoxes happen, but more importantly, they align with star systems. Now, as you know, the Earth has been traveling through this precession for the last, pretty close to 26,000 years. This is the angle of the Earth with relation to the zodiac, the 12 star systems that we can see from our planet. It takes about 26,000 years for the planet to, for the solar system to move through these 12 signs of the zodiac. We're coming to the end of this age and beginning the age of Aquarius. Why would that be so important? Why not the last age, or the one before that, or the one before that? The key is that this solar system is going to rendezvous with something in the cosmos. This section of the galaxy is being bombarded with a very unique set of frequencies. Those frequencies are beginning to have their effect on DNA. They're also having their effect on the sun, and they're having their effect on the other planets in the solar system. Now, these effects are very slight now, and solar scientists have been looking at the sun since records have been kept, and the sun is not acting like any of those times right now. We can't predict what the sun is doing. It seems every day I read a new theory from another solar scientist, where the sunspots have gone, why the coronal holes are not as frequent as they were, why is the sun so quiet? It's not been this quiet ever in history.
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm holding in my hand right now a report that I printed out today, this is from Matt Penn of the National Solar Observatory in Tucson, Arizona. And just one quick quote, he said, sunspot magnetic fields are dropping by about 50 Gauss per year. If we extrapolate this trend into the future, sunspots could completely vanish around the year 2015. And that's a quote.
Correct. Now, if you remember, about a year and a half ago, we were seeing solar reports that solar cycle 24 had begun. High latitude, reverse polarity solar sunspots had been located. A few showed up. They seemed to show the right kind of magnetic strength. And so they predicted at 2012 we were going to be at a solar maximum. And that solar maximum would have a lot to do with maybe even solar conflagration of the Earth. That is to say, the sun lines up on the opposite side of the Earth from the supermassive spinning black hole at the center of the galaxy, and that at a precise moment, somewhere around December 21st, the sun would have a huge solar flare, which would be pulled to the Earth by this extra gravity from a very thin concentrated band from this spinning black hole in the middle of the galaxy, and that those particles would be drawn across the Earth like a huge torch, like you saw in the movie Knowing with Nicolas Cage. This is the kind of theatrics that we're beginning to see come out. There's a movie getting ready to come out very soon called 2012, and it's from the same guy that brought us The Day After. And he went to the internet, did a lot of research, looked at a lot of websites, and said, holy cow, this is all doom and gloom, right down my alley. Let's get the CG artists out, and we'll make another blockbuster. Well, I'm here to tell you, all that can change, and all that is in our control. That's why all these edifices and all these civilizations built what they built, so that it wasn't 1890 or 1990 or even 2090. It would be 2012, exactly at the end of the age. Even Jesus said that these things would happen, the things that you read about in Revelations, at the end of the age. And he called it the Centella Aeon, which is what we're in right now, and it's about to end.
Okay, now you said that it takes about 26,000 years for our sun to make its circuit through the 12 signs of the zodiac. You said that in 2012, we are about to rendezvous with something. Okay, what? What is it we're about to rendezvous with?
Well, there are two main theories out there. One of them has significant empirical data. One is called the Black Axiom, and I think I've explained that once before, maybe a year ago on your program. This is a phenomenon that we began noticing when our telescopes got good enough. We started looking at the slow rotating bodies in our solar system, including our moon. What we notice is that these slow rotating bodies, like very large asteroids, our moon, are half coated with a black layer. Now, they think the black layer might be iron dust. It might be graphite balls. It could be just concentrated space dust. But it comes through very quickly because these slow rotating bodies, now our moon rotates once every 28 days. So if we were in a cloud of dust and small particles floating through space, and it took us years to go through it, then the moon would be universally coated with this stuff. But it's not. It's only half coated. It happens to be the side that faces Earth. The other side of the moon isn't coated at all, and it's six times brighter than the side that faces us. People call it the dark side of the moon, but it really isn't. It's the bright side of the moon. It just happens to be bright in a new moon when a new moon is facing us.
Mm-hmm.
We also found some very large asteroids, also half-coated, black on one side, white on the other side. Earth is a fairly fast-rotating body. It rotates in 24 hours. So we started looking at Earth, and we lay out this evidence in our first book of the Arc of Millions of Years. If that was true, then there would be a swath, like a pattern of meteorite strikes across our planet on only one side, sort of like taking a can of yellow paint and throwing it out on a spinning white canvas. And lo and behold, ending or starting right at the Carolinas, going across the Atlantic Ocean, on up into Siberia and across the pole, is exactly that. And on the floor of the Atlantic Ocean is about 1 meter deep of these iron pellets sitting on the floor.
Okay, and so what does that mean? I mean, what is this black axiom?
Well, you'll remember in the Book of Revelations, it talks about stars falling from heaven. Two people will be standing in the field. One will be struck and the other one won't. People will hide in caves and mountains, and their hearts will fail them because as these things come through the atmosphere, they're going to make sonic booms. So it's going to sound a little bit like bombs going off all the time. Now, it won't last long, but it will be, one of those events that you'll want to be alerted to so that you can survive, so that you can protect yourself.
Okay, but what is it, just a cloud of these things that's out in space? I mean,
it may be old cometary tail. It could be the remnants of a destroyed planet broken up into very small pieces. It doesn't show up from telescopes. It doesn't give off a gas tail, so it doesn't light up in sunlight, so we can't tell that it's there. But it does come around on a very regular basis. Now, how do we know when it came by? Well, we can look up at the moon pretty much every day, and we have really good telescopes that we can see the moon almost right down to the point where we can see where the Eagle Lander is on the surface of the moon. One of the things that we notice is that the side that faces Earth is pretty much universal with this dark layer. We also see some pretty large craters on the moon. And if the craters happened after the black axiom, those craters would be white, and they're not. The craters are coated just like the rest of the moon. Now, there's a few small little white dots there, but not like what you would expect if, say, that black axiom had happened 35 million years ago. But if it happened 25,000 or 26,000 years ago, it would still be pretty black, because the odds of the moon getting struck by a good-sized asteroid in the last 26,000 years are pretty slim. It's a pretty small body, about one-sixth the size of the Earth. And sure enough, that's what the data shows.
Okay, so about 26,000 years ago, we went through this black axiom, and the record is scattered across the side of the moon that we see. All right, now you said there's another theory of something that we may rendezvous with.
Yes. Now, the theory is that supermassive spinning black holes, since the days of Maxwell and other theorists that talk about black holes, because we've never actually seen one, but we have mathematically treated what we would consider a collapsed star and what it would go through, how fast it would spin, would it have mountains on it, would it have big spikes sticking off of it as it rotated around. And what we discovered was suns need to be about 1.4 times our sun before they have enough mass to actually collapse into a black hole, go through the red giant stage, and then the supernova stage, and then the brown dwarf stage, and then collapse into a black hole. Not very likely, but it could happen. However, much larger bodies can and probably do collapse into black holes. Now, the theorists are still struggling with this because they're trying to collect data with a series of observatories called the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatories. There's one in Hanover, Washington, which is just awesome. If you ever get in that part of the country, you need to go out there and see it. They'll give you a tour of it. They're trying to directly measure these black holes, but they haven't. And it may be because they can't get outside the box to look in. They're covered by the gravitational waves all the time, so they can't tell when they're on and when they're off. But it may also be because this supermassive spinning black hole doesn't stay round like a basketball. It flattens out like a dinner plate. Once these things get a couple of million suns inside of them,
we'll have to sit on the edge of our seats and wonder what happens with a couple of million suns till we come back after this break. We'll continue, folks, on the other side. And welcome back. We're talking with Brooks Agnew, and when the break took over, Brooks, you were telling us about what happens with a black hole. It flattens out like a platter, and once it gets, I think you said, a couple of million suns in it.
Yes. When black holes are pretty small, like 4 to 100 suns, they stay round like a black marble. But as they start consuming more and more mass over billions of years, they do not stay round anymore. They flatten out like a big dinner plate, like a big donut. And what happens is the singularity that was once easy to predict, being at the very epicenter of this point of no return called the event horizon, becomes a Heisenberg uncertainty. That is to say, we can't tell where or what size this singularity is. In fact, 99% of the matter on the inside of this black hole slings itself up against the event horizon, leaving the center of the black hole pretty much void of matter. However, this gravitational distortion of space-time begins to look a little bit like a giant sombrero. You have a bulge in the center, and then it flattens out all the way out to the very edge of the galaxy. And when we look at galaxies, and galaxy clusters and superclusters, that is exactly what we see. These galaxies have a tendency, by and large, to lay out like a giant spiral, dragging planets around, stars around a center, very high gravity area. Scientists are now, especially cosmologists, are coming to the agreement that inside every galaxy is a supermassive spinning black hole. It may in fact be the light engine that lights up all the stars in that galaxy to begin with. So that being said, what we have now is not an ordinary relationship like we have with our sun, where our sun is a central point of gravity and then we revolve around that sun and we spin on our axis just like the other eight planets in our solar system. What we have is a little different relationship here. We have a plane of very intense space-time ripples, very intense gravity, and along that plane rests a whole new set of frequencies and may also rest very dense matter. Some people call it dark matter. It could be called this black axiom, these very intense, highly dense crystalline particles laying along that fabric. So we are about to pass through that in December of 2012. Now, what are the effects that a very intense band of gravity would have upon a planet like ours? Well, considering about 4/7 of our planet is water, and water is very easily tugged around our planet by a little tiny body on the outskirts of our gravitational pull called our moon, which is 1/6 our gravity. Our tides are pulled around by that that body, that moon around us. It actually tidally stretches and squeezes our planet, and it moves water around our planet. On some areas of our planet, we see tides of 40 feet. Others, it's a mere 3 or 4 feet. Well, when you add this kind of gravity to that picture, you are now talking about gravitational shifts in the way water behaves on our planet.
Okay, so are we anticipating that the tides are going to become 100-foot tides, or and flood coastal areas for several miles? Or are we looking at the ocean sort of being pulled to one side of the planet, exposing what used to be ocean floor as dry land? What are we looking at here?
Actually, you're looking at several pictures just like that. Now, right now, let me go back 2 or 3 years. Shipping companies began to experience a phenomenon called a rogue wave. Now, rogue waves used to happen very rarely. Once every couple of years, you'd hear about them. Now, and I know this because we have a lot of logistical contacts now, we're beginning to get reports of these rogue waves once a month. Once a month, these rogue waves are happening. Now, what's a rogue wave? Right now, they're moving north to south, parallel to the coastlines. And they move subsonic, 300, sometimes 400 miles an hour. Where the water's deep, it is just a gentle swell in the water. It picks the ships up and it lays them right back down. Sometimes it nearly capsizes these ocean liners, and we have had a lot of complaints of injuries and spilled drinks and people dumped out of bed and things like that. It's a lot of water moving very quickly, but it's moving deep. When this gravitational effect begins to happen as our planet and our solar system passes through that, those waves are going to turn not parallel to the coasts, but perpendicular to the coasts. And what we are talking about here is not a tidal wave of 30 or 40 feet or even 30 or 40 meters. We're talking about tidal waves 400 to 500 meters high, traveling between 300 and 400 miles an hour.
All right, so one of those hits the western coast of the United States. It hits California. How far inland will that water travel?
It would probably splash up against the Sierra Nevadas.
Well, you know, see, you're describing something that is rather cataclysmic. There are millions and millions of people that live in that area.
Yes, there are. And if you had some kind of warning, if you had some kind of indicator that something like this might happen, you would think that you'd have the self-preservation drive to pack up the U-Haul and move to Kansas or move to Colorado. Get away from the coast for at least a year and wait for this to pass. I promise there'll be new beachfront property.
Okay. And that brings us to beyond 2012, because you said pack up and wait for this to pass. So what happens after the 2012 cataclysms?
Well, as it turns out, as I alluded to in the beginning of the program, human consciousness is tied into all this. Just because the planet is going to go through these cataclysms does not mean that the human race needs to end. Now, it has almost in the past. What happens is when these things happen without warning, is the people that know how to do stuff die. And so the people that have just been consumers, the buyers of the automobiles, the watchers of the TVs, the users of the cell phones, they don't know how to make a cell phone. They don't even know how to dig up iron and smelt it into ore. Those things are forgotten, and we are soon rubbing two sticks together to make fire. So this is a chance for the human race to take heed once in their 26,000-year cycle and move to higher ground for a little while and let the earth go through this. And then the people that know how to do stuff can be preserved. The people that know how to design this stuff, how to think of this stuff, people that, you know, you would think, well, gee, do they all live near the coast? Well, if you look at the way our nation is laid out, 80% of the people live within 20 miles of a coast. 80%!
That's true in a lot of countries. And, you know, I think that is probably because of shipping. Industry builds up around the ports, and, you know, it builds up near where it can get its supplies, because it's a lot cheaper to get your supplies from the port to do your manufacturing if you're within that 20 miles. If you're 200 miles from the port, you got to pay to ship it 200 miles. So I think probably because of shipping, don't you think?
Well, it could be. There are a lot of non-shipping businesses that live near the coast, too. It could be because human beings have an affinity and a need to be near water. Water, as it turns out, is a very unique molecule that has the ability to assimilate information. It has a ability to form matrices within the water that carry messages. And for some reason, human consciousness likes to be close to water.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll continue when we come back on the other side of this break. And very shortly, we'll be opening the telephone lines for you. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And for those of you who are just now joining us in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're glad you're here. You have missed a universe of information, and I can't help, but I hope you can join us for the first hour of each show. And if you can't, well, we're glad to have you. My guest this evening is Dr. Brooks Agnew. We're talking about this, the whole thing about 2012 and the end of time. It's been very, very much on television within the past week. And it's a topic of very high concern for a lot of people who listen to this show and who listen to other similar shows. Dr. Agnew, when we went away for break, we were talking about how people need to get away from the coastline. And you were saying that there are a lot of businesses that are near the coastline that have nothing to do with shipping and manufacturing. And that maybe, It's because we have a need for, an affinity for, water. And you'd just begun to describe some of the almost mystical properties of water.
Yes. Now, I'm kind of coming around full circle now, because the Earth is about to go through this plane of gravity. It's about to go through a shift. And one of the things that the Mayans talked about, and I recently had a conversation with Jose Arguez, who's really the guy that kind of started this whole 2012 thing back in the late 50s. And I was very privileged to have him on the program and get this out of him. But he said that there's also a kind of mystical date about this 2012. It's not all doom and gloom. Yes, there are physical cataclysms that are going to occur, but there's also a bombardment of the matter that makes up the human body with these higher frequencies, and it's beginning to switch the DNA on in people. There are latent abilities inside of people, and it's beginning to be switched on. One of the indicators that we're seeing is sort of a great enlightenment that happens to be going on around the world right now. And it really has nothing to do with religion. It has a lot to do with what people call spirituality. They don't really know why they're being turned on. They just notice that they're being turned on. Their senses are being heightened. Their ability to communicate telepathically, their ability to manifest things that they need or things that they desire is becoming greatly enhanced. And this is where the message of hope comes in. Because one of the things that we realize in the physics world is that all of the variables that we have in our formulas, whether it's the first, second, or third laws of thermodynamics, whether we're talking about particle wave dynamics, there's a component missing. And we're trying to figure it out right now, but we kind of know what it is. It's called consciousness. We don't have the variable yet. We don't have the constants yet. But we do see a relationship between the creation of matter or the exchange of matter with energy. Now, if that's the case, then human consciousness is involved with the creation of, manipulation of, matter. It is even involved in time. I recently asked a scientist, Dr. Ed Close, I asked him, you know, Einstein used to love to visualize what it was like to, say, run alongside of a light wave and then see what the universe looked like. I asked him, what would the universe look like if you were the light? And he paused for a second and he said, well, I guess since you're actually traveling the speed of light, time slows to nothing. Distance goes away. I guess everything would be now. I guess everything would be local. I said, right. So, in essence, to you, the photon traveling through space, the whole universe would be a singularity, would it not? He said, yes, it would. So I said, so really, there's no Big Bang at all. What's happened is, because we're in physical form, we have been able to slow time down ourselves individually as a race and experience distance and experience time, whereas particles that travel at the speed of light cannot. But we are really light beings, and we really can manipulate matter. What we can do is we can do it as a race, not so much as individuals. Yes, there are a few talented individuals out there that can levitate, that can disappear, that can do different things. You can watch it on the internet if you want. But as a race, if we were to enlighten and manifest the future the way we see it, we could actually move away from this cyclic destruction, rebirth, and having to rub two sticks together and then figure it all out again. We can actually transcend that and walk away from this 2012 as a complete race. That's the message of hope.
Okay. Now, I understand what you're saying on a theoretical level. On a practical level, how do you make that happen?
Well, of course, on a practical level, you can dig your bunker and you can wait it out. Put your two-year supply of food in there and do what the prophets have told you to do for the last 200 years. Or you can do what you do, that is, keep the airwaves hot and let people hear this message, let it resonate inside of them, and see if there's a spark of light inside of them that they say, you know what, that really makes sense. Now, here's a key that I'm going to give you that I don't know if anybody said it before, but it just really blew me away when it came out. When I started thinking about who built the pyramids and who built all these edifices and why, and then I started coupling it with the idea that maybe we live multiple lives, I realized that it was really us who built the pyramids. We built the pyramids so that we knew when we got to this section of our incarnations, we would need something to flip the memories on, to remind us who we are and what we are capable of doing. If we could just realize it was us and sort of slap ourselves on the side of the head and go, oh yeah, now I remember, this is what we're supposed to be doing. We can actually move away from this materialistic, capitalistic, fossil fuel burning society and become the beings that we have always been meant to be.
Okay. So people are listening right now, and there are some of them saying, yeah, that makes sense to me. This resonates with me. What is it they need? What's their next step? What is it they need to do?
That's a good question. One of the things that we realize in this physical world is we are basically biological transducers. I mean, face it, these physical bodies have very sophisticated spectrometers on them, mass spec, you name it. We can just about analyze it with our human body. But there are lots of frequencies we can't see. They're just too short or they're too long for our senses to figure out. It doesn't mean they're not there. We can sure pick them up with instruments, and there are things even beyond our instruments that we can't see. Once we realize the limitation of our physical bodies and we realize that we are locked into this thing called a wristwatch, which I happen to have one on my left wrist right now, and all of the toys that we are so driven by our society to accumulate, we lose sight of the real purpose. We lose sight of the real reward of being physical and being alive and growing and evolving. The thing to do is to turn the sound down just a little bit and try meditating. I mean, just clear your mind out and listen for a moment. You'll be surprised what you pick up. That's the first step. The second step is to realize that there are really three purposes of being a human being. That is to be, that is to do, and that is to have. Those three states of being. Unfortunately, most of our society, at least in the Western world, we are driven, concentrated, live and die for, it seems, on the have part. And we've forgotten all about the being part and the doing part. I was looking at statistics yesterday on the news, and it said 9.6% of adults are unemployed. 25.7% of teens are unemployed. More than one in four. So I thought to myself, what in the world's going on here? Well, it could be that seniors are taking up all their jobs. It could be that there just aren't enough jobs for unskilled workers. And it could be that teens just don't want to work. But it's probably because we are so driven to this having part that we don't want to let go of those earnings. We won't let. We won't share. I'm getting off track here. What I want to say, the point is that when we ask ourselves, what do we want to be when we grow up? I ask people that from age 8 to 80. And you'd be surprised, almost nobody knows the answer. They have no idea what they want to be when they grow up. I'm telling you, Kevin, that is a tragedy.
Well, you know, but the ones who have an answer almost invariably will answer incorrectly. You ask, what do you want to be? And they will answer, if they know something, if they've got an idea, they will answer in terms of what they want to do.
Correct.
I what do you want to be? I want to be a doctor. No, that's what you do. What do you want to be?
Yes. And being really is an action word. You can be doing work as a policeman, but you can be a very incredibly ascended being. You can work as a teacher, but you can be a very gracious leader and a healer almost. So there are things that the relationship between these three we have lost perspective of, at least in the Western world. In most of the rest of the world, I think they've given up thinking about having things. They haven't been raised in that kind of society. They're more concerned with doing things and with being. And there is satisfaction in all three, to be sure. But the most depressed, dark, vacant people that I know are the ones that are depressed because they don't have anything.
Yeah. I think you've hit the nail right on the head. It's a great description of where we are. And, one of the things that people really have to come to grips with is where we are is a result of a process. If you repeat the process, you repeat the results. And so if we're not happy with where we are, we cannot repeat the process that brought us here. It's got to change. And we as a species are pretty resistant to change.
Well, yes and no. I mean, we kind of like change. We get bored with things being the same way all the time. So people ask me from time to time, okay, so what do I do to change? I'm ready. I mean, I'm tired of the way things are. I'm not happy. I don't have the things that I want. I'm not doing what I love doing. In fact, I hate going to work every day. I throw up in the parking lot every day before I start work. What a dreadful way to live.
Mm-hmm.
A dreadful way to live. So we started going back to the mathematics, and we started looking at how the universe forms out of chaos. With consciousness applied, there are things that function and things that don't function in nature. As it turns out, there's a ratio. There's a ratio of applying energy that works with nature and a ratio that does not, or all other ratios do not. And that ratio is called the golden mean, 1.618 to 1. Okay, it happens to be a number called phi. It is used in all kinds of architecture, including the human body. The distance from the knuckle to the finger, from the finger to the hand, from the hand to the forearm. You know, all of those ratios, whether it's honeybees or sunflowers or seashells, everything obeys this natural resonance. It doesn't take very much energy. It just takes enough energy at the right moment to make incredible changes. It's called being in the zone. If you've ever played the game Tetherball,
mm-hmm.
where you hit the ball and it goes around the pole, and if you swing too soon, the ball loses energy and your opponent gets it. If you swing too late, the same thing. But a small amount of energy at exactly the right moment, and the ball goes around faster and faster and faster, and you win. There are times in playing sports that you just can do no wrong. Every ball you throw up goes through the hoop. Every swing you take goes over the fence. And so I started doing some research, and I wanted to figure out how in the world some people have all the luck and some people work and work and work and work and nothing ever goes right for them. It's because of this resonance. It's because of this ratio of energy, applying it at exactly the right moment. And so I really wanted to find out, okay, how many tries does it take? I mean, do you have to do it your whole life? Is it the first time out of the box it works? So I I said, "All right, I'll take two numbers, two completely random numbers." I think I took 25 and 256. They're far enough apart. They're not even. They're not multiples of each other. And I added them together. And I followed a Fibonacci sequence. That is to say, I added the two numbers together to get a third, and then I added the second and third to get a fourth, and I added the third and fourth together to get a fifth, and so on. When I got to the eighth number, I divided the seventh into the eighth, and I got 1.618. I said, "Holy cow, let's do it again." I took two more numbers, even further apart, and added them together and followed the sequence. Eight iterations, it worked again. It worked every single time. So I said, "Well, now, wait a minute. If I put forth an effort, like I go take a job interview and I get a job and 5 days later I'm fired, do I say, 'Oh, boy, that was a big failure,' or do I say, 'Okay, that's iteration one. What window opened up as a result of me having that job and getting fired?'" Go through the window. Go through the door. Follow it again and again and again for eight iterations. Now, do I just go off scattered like in the book The Celestine Prophecy? Or do I have some kind of way to figure out when it is I step? When it is I swing? When it is I actually take the phone call or make the email or go to the job interview or make the investment? Yes, there is. I highly suggest, as a method of preparation for people, that they learn how to meditate. I don't care what kind of meditation it is. There are some that are better than others. Different people have different preferences. The point is to get quiet and listen, because the universe is whispering all the time these very subtle energies. And you're going to know, because the note is going to be right. The frequency is going to be correct, and you're going to know when to move and what to do. And I thought to myself, okay, I've got the theory, I got the math, it seems to work. Let's go interview some successful people and find out how they did it. And sure enough, I interviewed baseball players, race car drivers, investors, real estate tycoons. I asked them, "How many times did you try before you were successful?" Eight. Every single time it was eight. They could almost name the sequences of failures that they had before they had a success. Now, some people, like Edison, had like 300 failures before he had a success, but that's because he tried everything and he didn't listen. If you listen, you can do it. You can do it. You can listen and you can change things.
Okay, speaking of listening, I want to open up the telephone lines so that our audience can call and ask their questions or make their comments. I do want to say to our audience, as I open the phone lines, when you call, we want to get as many calls in as possible. So collect your thoughts, and when we bring you up online, ask your question. And then we'll ask Dr. Agnew to answer that question as you hang up and we take another call. Okay, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Debbie from Columbus.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Thank you for having Dr. Agnew on again. It's always interesting and refreshing when he comes on the show to hear what he has to say.
Yes, it is.
I wanted to ask you, Dr. Agnew, have you read Greg Braden's latest book, Fractal Time?
You know, I just got one of his books, and I started reading it, and I'm really fascinated by the way he writes and the zeal that he puts into his studies. I can't wait to know more about the guy.
Well, it's a great book. I would recommend you reading it if you get a chance to. Also, one more question, Kevin, and then I'll get off the line.
Mm-hmm.
How was the expedition for the trip to the North Pole going? And I will take off.
A lot of people ask me that. Last 5 months ago, we contacted a Norwegian shipping line. We were going to get a 500-passenger ship instead of a 100-passenger ship like the Russians had originally offered us. We thought we could get the ticket price down by spreading the cost out over more people. That was a pretty good idea until the charter company came back and said the Russians will not let them go north of the 81st parallel. we need to go to the 86th parallel. So we are right back with the Russians, and we're going to continue with that path. We just started a Facebook widget as one of our funding efforts. We're going to be talking to some more funding sources this week to see if we can't put together the deposit and make this voyage happen. One thing we have discovered, the ice is refreezing, and it's refreezing at a record rate. So it looks like 2010, or it's never going to get done.
Okie dokie. All right, folks, the telephone number is 623-444-5889. If you need to call me toll-free, it is 888-223-4599. 888-223-4599. As always, if you live outside of the USA and you live outside of Canada, those numbers will work. You can call, but you may also send me a flash message by going to my website. Scroll down. You'll see the link that says flash message. Again, that's for folks outside of the USA, outside of Canada. And please, confine your flash message to something related to the show. If you are sending me a comment about something else or a suggestion, please use our contact page. Because flash messages not related to the show get deleted, and I don't see them, okay? All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. Kevin in North Carolina.
Hi, Kevin.
I'm going to try to be brief here, unlike me. I'd actually like to answer two questions and maybe get Dr. Agnew's reaction.
Okay.
One was an implied question. One was one you asked directly. The implied one is, what's the point? And your question is, what do we do? You know, as in, what do we do now?
Mm-hmm.
My question of is, you know, what's the point? What is going on? Why is the Earth going to go through this? What's the big cosmic scheme point of all this? I'm going to go back to something I was taught 20 years ago about what's to come, and was kind of had to keep it to myself. Nobody's been ready to hear it.
Okay, keep it brief.
Do what?
Keep it brief.
Okay. The Earth's in the middle of a consciousness split. A polarity split. Basically, people are being divided up into two groups.
All right, and we have to divide what you're going to say. The break just took over, so you'll have to hang on. And we'll be back, folks, on the other side of this break. Hang in there. Welcome back, and we have Kevin online. We also have Dr. Brooks Agnew online. Kevin, make it real brief. We have other calls lined up.
Okay. In the show, Dr. Agnew said that as a race we can evolve or not. Kind of made it sound like all or nothing. And what I'm suggesting is that there's a split in consciousness, whereas there's two groups. One group can go on, another group won't. Which group are you going to get in? Well, one group is those people that are all about love, union, that, you know, that whole polarity. The other group is fear, division, separation, distance, as he mentioned it. And to answer your question, what do we do now? You know, the old saying, think globally, act locally. It's what you do immediately around you. Love anybody around you. Smile at the people at the post office. Stop and help somebody open the door when they've got that handful of groceries. You will pull yourself into or pull that environment of love around you, and you'll end up in that space. And as he's saying, you know, all the cataclysms and stuff, they'll go around you if you're in that state of love. I think he was trying to allude to it. But I'll leave it at that. I'm going to listen off there for the comments. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Well, Kevin, you're exactly right. In the first book, we call it The Union of the Polarity. In the second book, we address it again. This is where all consciousness comes together to make up this Earth. But as the Earth is beginning to go through this division, the higher vibrational matter and the lower vibrational matter are going to go in two different directions. They're going to divide. They're going to go into different dimensions. And as it turns out, they are at different vibrational levels. The beings that resonate with the higher vibrational level are going to go with that section of the world, or that section of the dimension. And the beings that vibrate with the lower vibrational matter are going to stay behind. I hate to say stay behind or go on, but this grand division is well documented in all of the ancient writings. And it is what we see before our eyes. We look at, for instance, the optimist and the pessimist living in the same town, even the same household. The optimist says, we live in the best of all possible worlds. And the pessimist fears that's true.
Oh, mercy.
They totally have different perspectives. You know, two men in prison. One is totally happy. The other one's absolutely miserable and can't wait to get out. It is exactly the way Kevin said. All the cataclysms, all the woe, all the destructive evil forces are going to go right around or right through you, because they're not going to resonate with you or the matter that makes up your body.
All right, let's go back to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Brent from Wyoming.
Hi, Brent.
Hi, Kevin. Brooks, I have a favor to ask of you. You're a physicist, and I'm sure you have some grad students. Could you talk one of them into doing a model of the solar system, a computer model of the solar system, and find out what would happen if a brown dwarf were to pass through our solar system every so often? Because from what I've heard, the vast majority of the solar systems in our galaxy are dual, have two suns or more.
Yeah, and it looks like our solar system, it looks like, is the same way. If you look at the two shafts that are in the Great Pyramid, it lines up with Sirius. It lines up with Sirius now, and it lined up with Sirius when it was built. That means that our sun is revolving around another star very close to Sirius, or Sirius itself. We are actually a binary star system. And that's exactly what's going on. Now, I don't have to run a computer model. By the way, I'm not an astrophysicist. My specialty is in analytical analysis or instrumental analysis. However, I don't have to run a model because we have the works of Emmanuel Velikovsky, who ran this exact scenario in his book called Worlds in Collision. And he actually says that there's enough evidence from the planets inside our solar system and the absence of one planet that should be there that's not there, that indicates that a very heavy gravitational mass came through our solar system, maybe not on the same plane as our solar system, but came through between the sun and Earth and took away one planet and fractured the surface of Mars. Now, what would happen if it passed close enough to Earth is exactly what Kevin was talking about before. All the oceans would come around the Earth on the side of this gravitational body passing by Earth, and they would follow it until it was out of gravitational distance, and then all the oceans would settle back into the low places of the Earth. Obviously, that would be devastating.
Well, and because of the fact that the planet is rotating, those oceans would be pulled toward that gravitational body. However, as the Earth rotates, that means that water would be passing over all of the Earth.
That's right, except for the very high mountains, you would be talking about a global flood scenario.
Okay, is that possibly the explanation for the flood referred to as Noah's flood?
Could be. It could very well be. Now, that's probably recent enough that is probably the explanation for it. I mentioned before that some of the Earth is very, very old, 4.5 billion years old, and some is very young, 10 to 70 million years old. I'm referring to the ocean floors. At one time, the Earth was much, much smaller than it is right now, and all of the continents were much closer together. The continental shelves actually touched one another, which meant water covered most of the Earth. Only the very high mountains and high plains were out of the water. But as the planet expanded, the ocean receded down into the ocean beds, and that's why the ocean floors are so young, because they're freshly added from magma activity from the center of our crust.
All right. Let me say that the telephone numbers are 623-444-5889 or toll-free 888-223-4599. Dr. Agnew, it's December the 22nd, 2012. What am I looking at?
Well, you're probably looking at a planet in somewhat of recovery. I think that between now and then, there will be significant economic upheaval. We're already seeing the results of that. We're pouring billions and billions of dollars down the rat hole of big car makers and other things that will never be able to make a profit again because of the way the economy is right now. We need, at that point, we're going to be rethinking the way that we do commerce. Now, I know we hear a lot about one world government and how bad it can be, but we really need to start looking at ourselves as a planet. And maybe 2012, December 22nd or January 1st, 2013, we are going to start looking sociologically and economically at our planet as a single world.
All right, let's go back to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. Dr. Agnew, this is Mike calling from Kentucky.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike. Very good show tonight.
Thank you.
I have a little short story here I want to share with you. I mean, it's not very long at all. It's called Two Wolves. One evening, an old Cherokee told his grandson about a battle that goes on inside of people. He said, "My son, the battle is between two wolves inside all of us. One is evil. It is anger, envy, jealousy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. The other is good. It is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith." Grandson thought about it for a minute, and then asked his grandfather, "Which wolf will win?" The old Cherokee simply replied, "The one you feed."
Yeah, that's true.
I think that we can look around at society and see which one appears to be winning, but may not be what it's going to be.
Well, I appreciate the call. I think we can see which one we've been feeding.
Well, you can see the one Fox News feeds every 30 minutes. I mean, every news agency 24 hours a day, every 30 minutes, will recycle the same kidnapping, the same bomb explosion, the same plane crash over and over and over again, and that's how they make money. My response to this is both of these happen in everyone. And I think the most benevolent, kind, gracious, healing, patient, long-suffering people in some incarnation or another were once envious, angry, superior, and full of ego, and they overcame it.
All right. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, hi, Kevin. This is Ryan in Puget Sound.
Hi, Ryan.
Yeah. Do you think that since this has happened before, the human race, because of all these floods and let me gather my thoughts here. I kind of forgot what I was going to say. Possibly that because we keep getting set back every so many thousands of years that we should be much more evolved and advanced than what we are now. But because of these continuities, if this happens every so many thousands of years, then we'll be set back and all of our technology will be lost and we'll have to start over again. So possibly that could be one of the reasons why we're still kind of stuck on this planet. We haven't developed enough technology to move to other planets because of these continuous cataclysms that happen over so many thousands of years. Basically, what my question is, I guess, kind of a long-winded question there, but
all right,
I'll just I know the callers are
off. Exactly what you're asking. We were sitting around talking about this the other night. What, you know, about ancient civilizations and how advanced they were, and they had diamond-studded saws and, you know, advanced abilities to align roads and do great excavation projects without any rubble and all this stuff. And I said to the group, well, who keeps pushing the control alt delete button? I mean, why do we just get to our zenith and then some cosmic force comes in and just resets the whole thing and we're back in loincloths again? And so one of the groups said, well, maybe that happens all the time. Maybe it's a natural cycle. I said, well, if that's true, then there are no UFOs visiting our planet. Because every society in the entire cosmos would get to a certain point where they're just about ready to take flight and become evolved into this higher being, and then bam, their planet knocks them right back down to cave people. It doesn't have to be that way. We are the creators, and we, as a collective race of consciousness, can move to a higher level and leave these petty wars and these battles and these jealousies, competitions, and lack and scarcity behind.
All right, we're just about to a break. Caller, are you willing to hang on through the break?
Yep.
All right, hang in there. All right, folks, we have to step away for a couple of minutes here for our final break of the evening. And we'll be back with Brooks Agnew and the caller we have on hold. And maybe we'll have time for you to call as well, right after this. Right, welcome back. We have Dr. Brooks Agnew with us this evening. And caller, are you still with me?
Yes, I am, Kevin.
All right, your first name and where are you calling from?
My name's Ozzy. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Ozzy? Are you a first-time caller, Ozzy?
I'm Avi. This is my third time.
Oh, Avi. Okay, I thought you said Ozzy, and I didn't remember an Ozzy. Okay, Avi, go ahead.
Well, very interesting show tonight. Dr. Agnew, hi. My question is pretty quick. You were mentioning about those eight successes, eight attempts, I guess, that people go through, that whole concept there. That seemed interesting to me. Maybe talk a little bit about that, where that comes from. And also, it's optimistic, I guess, what you were talking about, the coastlines. You know, not all the big cities are on the coast. And, all right. I guess that's it. I'll take the rest off the air.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you explained the where you got the eight tries from was from the golden mean.
And the Fibonacci sequence.
Yeah. All right. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Stefan from Quebec City, Kevin. How are you?
Outstanding.
Dr. Agnew, great to hear you again. I was on your show not too long ago, and fascinating topic. I was wondering...
Thank you.
In terms of the whole 2012 thing is, and people talk about ascension, I'd like to know your opinion on this. Is ascension dying? Is it leaving the physical body behind?
No, actually, ascension is not dying, and there's a difference between ascension and resurrection. With the second, you actually have to die and then you come back in a resurrected body. That's a different process than ascension. And ascension can be a multi-step process. You can actually have ascension experiences where you literally change forever. You never go back to who you were before. You're a much higher vibration. You're much more patient, much more loving, much less materialistic person. Those are the outward effects. The inward effects are you become aware, you become awakened, you sense beyond the future and beyond the past. Everything becomes now to you. And, of course, complete ascension would be, you know, reaching a light body where you are actually in an immortal physical form. You never have to go back to being mortal again. You never have to be born again. It's talked about four times in the Bible alone. And it's well talked about in other scriptures like the Book of Enoch, the Sumerian writings, and in the Sefer Yetzirah. However, one has to think about whether that is the goal or not. If you want to be ascended and you want to leave the physical struggle once and for all, you're basically making a statement, I've learned everything I need to learn from mortality. I'm ready to overcome everything and never become mortal again. I don't know very many people that are there, and I also think that the mortal experience, whether it's full of pain and suffering and illness and war and death, or whether it's full of love and birth and abundance and wealth, is all experience that the spirit inside of our body has to have. And we'll eventually get all of those experiences. Now, one has to also think, gee, do I want to go back and do this over and over and over again and never get it right? I want to keep repeating the mistakes over and over again? No. That's where ascension comes in very handy. You actually learn what you needed to learn in this life, and you are ready to evolve. That is a fantastic feeling and a wonderful realization.
Okay, very quickly, I have a flash message from Mexico. Umberto says, is it true that near-Earth incoming objects are now classified military information? I don't know. Do you know the answer to that, Dr. Agnew?
Well, yeah, I kind of do. It's that all of the big telescopes, the ones that we really count on to look way out into space, are already under contract for a couple of years out. Every single minute of their viewing time has been bought and paid for, and it has to run those contracts. They just don't have enough time to look for near-Earth objects. That being said, there are literally hundreds of thousands of amateurs out there with excellent telescopes, and they're looking for near-Earth objects, and they're using very good techniques. They're using digital photography of the same quadrant of the sky over and over again so they can see what moves. Virtually every comet that's been discovered in the last 20 years has been discovered by amateurs because they have really great equipment out there. So I'm not really afraid of anything within visible light range of coming to Earth without somebody, some observer out there catching it, because there are a lot of people looking, a lot of people.
Okay, his second question is, can you answer the following? Do you know anything about censorship in Google Sky and Microsoft Worldwide Telescope?
I don't know anything about that. One thing I do know is that according to the Data Denial Act of 2006, no real-time data is given to the general public out of satellites. That means that everything that Google shows you as Google Earth that's above the 60th parallel is animated. It isn't real.
Fair enough. Then it is censored.
Yes, it is censored due to the Data Denial Act, which basically says, and this is a global cooperation between EUMETSAT and the NOAA. No real-time data to the general public from those groups of satellites during times of conflict or war. You could look it up yourself.
Boy, I wish we had time to talk about that, but we don't. We're just about out of time. Dr. Agnew, as always, is fascinating when you're on the show, and I want people to know where they can go to get your books that talk about these things. So where can they do that?
Sure. The best place, I mean, you can get them from Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all that, but the best place to get them is at arcofmillionsofyears.com, because if you buy from there, you can get the trilogy all as a package, and you get the first two books in audio format as a download for free. So if you're not a big reader, don't worry about it. Put the books on the shelf. I read them for you.
Fair enough. And folks, the way, if you can't remember that, the way to get there is to click Dr. Agnew's picture on my website, and it will take you there. Okay? It's linked. It will take you there. And then you can get the books. Now, there are two volumes, right?
There are three volumes. There's New Discoveries in Light on the Creation. There's 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times. And now there's Unlocking the Secret. So it's 1,500 pages of what some universities are saying is the most comprehensive work ever written on the 2012 end times.
I guess my first clue should have been when you said trilogy.
Yeah. Yeah, like trigonometry.
Oh, outstanding. Okay. If you will, stay on the line with me for a moment as we come to the close here. And it's again, thank you for being with us. I know you're a very, very busy man. I look forward to you being with us on September the 18th to talk about what you're doing with electric cars and alternative energy. And I think that's going to be a tremendous show. All right, folks, we're at the end. I wish we had more time, but we don't. I want to tell you that, again, we're doing a series this week on 2012 and the end times. And the reason for that is because of the increase in the amount of email I've gotten about those subjects from you. We've got some great guests coming tomorrow night. John Ventry, who's written a book about this, and he'll be my guest tomorrow night, talking about 2012 and end times. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.